Sorry to let the music run, but we had very important things to discuss. Hey, good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable and to our discussion this morning. We have an incredible panel. We have a lot to talk about, and we'll get to it. Let me just let you know that all you have to do to get in on the game is to write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We would love your letters. And just keep them short, keep them to the point. Proofread them so we know what you're trying to say. But the short part is key.
It's really important.
I'm sorry?
It's really important.
Yeah, it is very important.
So we can read more letters.
Libby Post is back. She is a political consultant. She joins us every Monday and Tuesday. Today's a Tuesday, and here she is.
And here
good
I
morning.
Good
Thank
morning.
You very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Our good buddy J.P. Miller is off for a couple of weeks doing what people should do, and that's vacation. And so... he's still working, actually, on his vacation, but that's okay. But he's not here, so we are thrilled that Chris Churchill could fill in. Good morning, sir. He is a columnist for the Times Union, and always nice to have Chris with us.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. Mike Spain, also from that newspaper, the Times Union. He is the associate editor there, and he joins us every Tuesday as well. Good morning.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you here as well. Alan Shartok is with us. Good morning, Alan.
Well, yes, good morning. But last night at 7 o'clock, Roselle looked out the window of our house in Great Barrington. There was this fire truck that went from one end of the street. It was huge with a big thing on top of it.
You sure it's not just a short street?
No, no, it's a short street, but it was a big fire truck. So I ran down to say, what are you guys doing? I thought maybe
what the hell are you guys doing?
Your house was on fire? Was your house on
fire? Well, that's what I thought. You know, maybe it was, but no. The guy who was running the operation said, no, this is a training session, and we've decided to train on your house. So they, the Shartok guys. Now,
they didn't tell you?
In advance?
Yes.
No.
Did they set it on fire?
No, and
they didn't say anything. What did they do? Were people walking on the roof?
No, they have this thing. It goes up in the air, and this is a big house. It's
the
three stories.
Yeah,
there's a bucket. And there's a very young man. Controlling the thing, and then it goes way up in the air, and he's touching the chimney, and I'm saying, from the Department of Paranoia, I think I see a column coming soon.
Yeah, that's incredible. So,
well, think of it the other way. If there ever were a tragedy
and
there was a fire, they would be already
skilled
at going after
that's
that
what he
fire.
Said. That's what he said.
I think I just see the meeting prior to this, and they're like, oh, well, where do we go practice? Oh, well, let's go save Shartok.
Let's go have Shartok's out.
Yeah, we'll save Alan. Yeah,
let's just make sure that happens.
Right. So I think that's good.
Yeah,
I would take it as a compliment. Good morning again. Welcome, panel at WAMC.org. And we are going to start. Here are the stories for the day. I always love this moment where I go to find the one email that I sent and then realize that because if somebody responds to it, then it goes away, you know?
Then you got to get
the gift of Outlook.
That's right. So
really?
I have found it, and I'm now ready to start. So let's begin with North Korea. This is what, according to U.S. spy agencies, North Korea is working on new missiles. What, you say? U.S. spy agencies are seeing signs that North Korea is constructing new missiles at a factory that produced the country's first intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of reaching the United States, according to officials familiar with the intelligence. Newly obtained evidence, including satellite photos taken in recent weeks, indicates that work is underway on at least one and possibly two liquid-fueled ICBMs at a large research facility on the outskirts of Pyongyang. And according to the officials, they describe this as classified intelligence. The findings are the latest to show ongoing activity inside North Korea's nuclear and missile facilities at a time when the country's leaders are engaged in arms talks with the United States. The new intelligence does not suggest an expansion of North Korea's capabilities, but shows that work on advanced weapons is continuing weeks after President Trump declared in a Twitter posting that Pyongyang was no longer a nuclear threat.
Well, it's all about how you interpret it. The story in the Washington Post, which broke this news, quotes a guy from a East Asian non-proliferation program at some think tank, and they use satellites photographs to document this, and they were saying that it's probably a different way of looking at it. And in a way, Trump might be correct that they're no longer a nuclear threat because they're no longer going to test ICBMs and they're going to put up with certain limits. But what North Korea was really looking for, they suggest, was recognition that they do have nuclear weapons and that they are a nuclear power. They're just going to cooperate and not be a threat. So everybody has nuance here. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, it seems, though, that this after the talks that took place earlier in the summer, that we were at a place where this would not be happening. And if this is happening, then that would be bad, right?
Well, you know, Trump will try to spin it in some way, saying, well, we had an agreement. They're not going to become nuclearized. So there's no way that those are nuclear missiles. They're building something else. I mean, you know, he's going to come up with something. Or he'll tweet and say, you broke your promise, I'm going to bomb you now. That's what we have.
I mean, I think other presidents have learned, too, that they're a country that you trust cautiously, if you trust them at all. I mean, they have a history of not necessarily living up to whatever agreement they may have made, and we don't even really know what exactly they made in this case.
Malcolm Nance made that clear when he was sitting in your very chair, Chris.
Oh, yeah?
Laughing when it looked like Trump was going to get a Nobel Prize for what he was doing.
I mean,
and he laughed and he said,
I mean, it's a vague pledge to work towards denuclearization of the peninsula. That's what they came up with.
Well, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, was talking about this last week when he went before the Senate committees, and he insisted that North Korea was still on track and they were intending to dismantle the nuclear arsenal. It's just getting underway, and he actually said, we have not been taken for a ride by the North Koreans.
That's interesting. It's also interesting that this intelligence leaked. I mean, where is that coming from exactly?
In our agencies, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would assume the Trump administration would not want that to leak since it doesn't really reflect positively on the meetings that they had. But
it's probably somebody from the deep state who's worried about things and they want to get the information out there. But it could be a whistleblower. It could be somebody legitimately concerned that North Korea is continuing to develop nuclear weapons and that we shouldn't pretend that otherwise, and the public should know about it.
Well, I think it's also could very well be someone who's just concerned with Trump's continual undermining of the intelligence community. You know.
Well, good points.
You know.
As for me, I love my dog, Murray.
Do you?
Because,
he's sweet.
You know, they eat dog over there.
For
me and all dog lovers,
personal.
Right.
And I know we can hold your letters about the cows.
But there's a movement. There's a movement over there spurred by international folks who love dogs and who do animal work to stop it. And there are some folks that have stopped using dog as meat in Korea. Which is lovely, which is great, but it's just horrible.
That's a cultural issue.
Yes, it is. It is.
But, so you know, there's this lemonade stand.
Well, let's make some lemons into lemonade, shall we?
That's what we said. Trump is trying to make lemonade out of the lemons that North Korea sends our way.
Show hit a bit of a roadblock there, didn't it?
But speaking of lemonade,
So this kid sets up a lemonade stand, and you had the story, Mike. How much is he charging?
I believe he was 70 years old.
Yeah,
and he
the little
he lives
critter
out his
the evil capitalist trying to make money.
Right. He sets up a little lemonade stand outside near the entrance of the Saratoga County Fair in the town of Ballston Spa, or the village of Ballston Spa, and is undercutting the lemonade salespeople within this inside the fair. He was selling for 75 cents a couple lemonade. And
pretty good deal, I have to say.
It is because they were selling it for like $7.
Yeah,
were they really?
And he was also selling snow cones and
that's where you got in trouble.
Some soda, I guess Kansas soda or something. But it turns out, according to the story today by our reporter Wendy Libertor, who's all over this story,
wall to wall coverage in the Times.
Wall to wall coverage, and on Times Union.com.
Like Greenwich Nation. creative.
And by the way, all over the country, this is
New York Post today on the front page.
It's all over the Empire Report today, too. JP's on vacation, and he's still putting this on top of his page. Anyway, it did happen that over the weekend a woman who was wearing a uniform that's worn by the State Health Department, Department of Health in New York State, went over and told the kid he had to shut down. And when the word got out and the media got all over it, people started to complain, and they said this was unfair. A kid should be allowed to do this. He's learning business principles. It's a free country. Even State Senator James Tedesco, whose district includes Ballston Spa in Saratoga County, came out to support the kid and says, that the State Health Department should cover his lost profits for shutting him down. But because he does have the snow cones and he has the cans of soda, the Health Department is saying, we don't want to shut anybody down, we don't want to hurt anybody, but that does elevate to the level of a stand that requires a permit. So that's where it is right now.
This is almost as important a story as North Korea. I don't have any doubt about it, but it's so fascinating to me to what guys like you, editors, and Chris's column, I'm sure, will be coming out on this.
Very hot take coming up.
We all know intuitively what people out there want to know about. And they want to know about, a kid who's been screwed out of selling, lemonade. We have a nice little lemonade stand on Sumner Street in Great Barrington, and I try to patronize a lovely young woman.
I thought that's how WMC made its fund drive.
No.
Not a bad idea, actually.
It's not a major story. It's certainly not, but it's one that
it
does
is a major
capture,
story.
Why is that, Chris?
Because it captures something that people feel uncomfortable with, and that's, this isn't just happening here. It's happening everywhere
How do you know what's happening?
You see fewer and fewer kids outside. You see fewer and fewer kids being allowed to do things
except
like this.
Except in Fierbusch.
Are there other legal issues like this involving lemonade stands across the country?
So my question is, when you go down outside the Saratoga race course, there's kids on almost every corner selling lemonade.
Not anymore. Well, they banned the bottles, the water sellers there. That was an issue that I think was last summer it was coming up, that the kids, they wanted to keep the kids from selling bottles of water out on the corner. So, I don't know.
And they would undercut what you could get water for inside the track.
God forbid.
It just makes it look, the track and the Saratoga Fair, it makes them look petty for making a big deal.
In New York City, for a long time, the restaurants would complain about
the
food trucks.
Yes, I know.
And now there's food trucks everywhere. And I think that's all been...
Everywhere, and it's everybody's waiting in line.
Still complain about food trucks, and part of me gets it. The business is paying property tax and rent and stuff. But on the other hand, a food truck is a great way for somebody without a lot of money to start a business and get it going.
And the Times is now reviewing some of the food trucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pretty good. And of course, this whole business, Joe, if I may just go there for a second.
We have 2 minutes.
Just go there for a second, is the idea that there's always an organized lobby, like in the case of the insiders versus the outside of the park. But for example, Airbnb, which is under serious attack right now, and the Massachusetts legislature is going to slap a 5.7% tax on Airbnb. I have to admit, Roselle runs a little Airbnb, you're supposed to say that when it happens, and then it turns out, of course, that the real estate lobby is there and doing their thing,
and the hotel lobby is probably pushing for it because it's undercutting them in New York City. But then it's being abused too. Some people are just renting apartments and never living in them at all and just renting them out on Airbnb.
Yeah.
You need some kind of rules
that ain't
gets to a certain scale. But a kid, 7-year-old kid, little Brendan Mulvaney of Ballston Spa, maybe I don't think he is elevated to that level.
Nor do I.
Do you know what? What's his name?
Brendan Mulvaney.
Brendan. So if Brendan brings in, let's say, even if he were to make $10,000 a summer, on his lemonade stand. He still couldn't pay for his college education.
And he never made $10,000.
Well, no, that's the point. Yeah, I mean, right. Like, what are we doing? How many snow cones did he actually sell?
Yeah. You know, but the thing, yeah. So he has to get a permit. Does that mean he has to get a sales tax permit too?
And does he have to be inspected? Is the health inspector?
That's
have to
right.
Come around?
Well, I mean, a permit is $30, but I don't know about the sales tax.
Sales tax doesn't cost you anything except that you have to pay it. You don't need to pay for the permit.
By the way, it looks like from the photos that you all were showing, it looks like a nice stand. I mean, it looked very nice.
Yeah. Pleasant.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't look like a.
We haven't seen any lemonade reviews just yet, but
yeah, we
sure
don't know
pretty,
if it's
pretty...
a rather tart lemonade or more sweet.
I tracked TripAdvisor and Yelp, and they both gave it very high marks. So, all right, let's take a break.
Could you imagine though the headache at the New York State Department of Health and the Public Affairs Department right now?
I feel sorry for Gary Holmes, their spokesman.
I mean, really.
they're talking about the Red Hub right now.
And you can imagine somebody on the end of the phone from the second floor.
Let's talk about more pressing issues.
All right, we'll talk about more pressing issues. We will. Maybe actually, right after the short break.
Okay.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Alan Chartok is here. Mike Spain joins us, as does Chris Churchill and Libby Post. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We are, let's move on to the tax cut story, which is coming out this morning that the Trump administration is mulling a unilateral tax cut for the rich. The Trump administration is considering bypassing Congress to grant a $100 billion tax cut mainly to the wealthy, a legally tenuous maneuver that would cut capital gains taxation and fulfill a long-held ambition of many investors and conservatives. Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, said in an interview on the sidelines of the Group of 20 summit meeting in Argentina this month that his department was studying whether it could use its regulatory powers to allow Americans to account for inflation in determining capital gains tax liabilities. The Treasury Department could change the definition of cost for calculating capital gains, allowing taxpayers to adjust the initial value of an asset, such as a home or share of stock, for inflation when it sells. If it can't get done through a legislation process, we will look at what tools at Treasury we have to do it on our own, and we'll consider that, according to Mr. Mnuchin.
Well, this is pretty interesting because it is evidence that the White House knows that the Congress doesn't want to do something else that will benefit the rich, and that if it's going to get done, this benefit for people who sell lots of stock or houses over $500,000, et cetera, that the which is primarily the rich, the wealthier people, if it's going to get put into effect, it would have to be unilaterally, like by an executive order or a change within the IRS ordered by the president or by the Treasury Department. And I guess George Bush tried that back in the 90s, the first Bush, right. And they evaluated it and they said this wouldn't win the test of a court challenge or anything like that. So they didn't do it, and it would need to be an act of Congress. So,
well, go ahead. You know, the Constitution is pretty explicit about, you know, who has the power of taxation, and it's obviously a congressional prerogative and always has been.
Right.
And should be,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah. They're just talking about changing the definition of the word cost. So if you bought a stock in 1990 for $1,000 a share and you sell it in 2018 for $3,000, your capital gains is $2,000. This would allow them to say, well, $1,000 in 1990 is really $2,000 in 2018. So it's only a $1,000 capital gain. They say it'll save a lot of people, you know, $40,000, $50,000 when they play around with their portfolio, which is, you know, good pocket change.
Yeah, great pocket change. This might also be an indication that they know they're going to lose the House.
Well, I was going to ask that. I mean, it seems as though this is just yet another, this can't play well.
No.
But
no.
Why would they want to put the Republicans up for re-election on the spot? Forcing them?
I don't think the House would go for it even if Republicans keep it. I don't see that happening. I mean, even the tax cut bill passed fairly easily in the House, but it was obviously pretty close in the Senate. I don't know. I don't think that the Republicans in the House, maybe I'm overestimating them would go along with
I think that if they keep the House in November, mm-hmm. I think they would definitely do something like this.
By the way, for all of you who assume that the Democrats are going to take the House, don't.
Yeah, I know.
There's some very interesting polling.
I have to be hopeful.
No, well, yeah, sure, I get it. On the other hand, it's also a matter of how hard people are willing to work to take the House back. You got an awful lot of things that could go wrong. For example, and I think it was the Times had a wonderful story on this. It may have been the Post. Maybe it was you guys. The gerrymander is so, you know, for so many of these districts, the Republicans have such an advantage. I think the real trick here is for people to get out and campaign.
Absolutely. And I don't think that anybody's not doing that. You know, I think that everybody's got their own way of campaigning, and some people might not be as open and accessible to the press as we would like them to be, but I think people are doing the field work that they need to do in order to win, because ultimately you can have all the press, all the great mail, which is, you know, the stuff I do, and all the great messaging in the world, but if you don't have a field operation and you don't identify your voters and turn those people out to vote, that's when you lose.
Well, you also have to have an appealing candidate, right?
Exactly.
Yes.
I think we tend to nationalize these elections, but on the local level, they're often very much mm-hmm. about, well, I like that guy.
Right.
He's my congressman, or I don't like
right.
this guy. You know, so right. so it's about finding a candidate that's well tailored to the district right. and has a history in the district.
It's like Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I mean, there's a couple in the Hudson Valley, the greater capital region, that have gotten some national attention. The John Faso, who's running for re-election, he's a very newbie in the House of Representatives, although a very, very well-known former state assemblyman and politician, is facing a tough re-election. There was a Democratic primary to pick the candidate, and Antonio Delgado won that primary and is now challenging him. And a lot of people are looking at that, and I haven't seen a lot of that going on. I don't know how that's going. I haven't seen the candidates out there, I think.
Well.
Oh, he's out there.
Yeah. No, they're both out there.
They're out there. Everyone's
what's
out there
sense?
Doing
door
to door.
I mean, any polling yet on this? Any
yes.
public polling?
Well, I actually looked at 538 this morning, and the Democrats have Delgado ahead by 7.
That was a DCCC
right,
poll,
the DCCC
right?
DCCC yeah. poll. Yeah. I'm interested to see if Sienna comes out with something, or
Marist or
Quinnipiac come out with something, and then we'll be able to really see.
Well, you know, there are a lot of places here that that could go wrong for the Democrats. Mm-hmm. For example, my friend Sean Patrick Maloney, who is running for two offices at once, which is a big mistake. And let's assume he gets to win in the attorney general. That's one thing. Primary. But if he doesn't, then he goes back to that district. People may be slightly a tad angry that he pulled that. You mean we're only second best?
Yeah, he's simultaneously running in the primary for attorney general and running in the general election for Congress. And that, that I agree. I think people will look at that and say, but I guess he could argue that he wants to be a public servant.
Well, that's great, but I think it's
wants
bad
his
timing.
Cake, eat it too.
Yes,
right.
exactly.
Oh, yeah. I think it's bad timing on his part, because he could go Republican.
Absolutely. It has.
Right. It has. It used to be Nan Hayworth's seat.
And it's a four-way Democratic primary, isn't it? I think so.
No, the primary's over.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you mean for the
Oh, you mean for the
attorney
AG?
General.
Yes. It's four-way. He's
attorney
the
general.
Only man in the race.
And three
and
others are looking for it.
He's a gay man in the race.
And he's white.
And he's white. And so, Zephyr's white. And the other two candidates are women of color, black women.
And that could split the vote anyway. It'll be interesting.
All right. I would like to go into this a little bit further. There's a Nate Cohn piece in the New York Times today, 98 days to go till the November election, and he's talking about the battleground in this fight for control of the House, which is starting to come into focus. So I'd like to focus in on that and talk a little bit more about what we've started to discuss. We will do that right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And let's go to the story I was talking about. This is from Nate Cohen. It was published yesterday. So his article says 99 days. I am going to do the quick math since it was written yesterday.
Now it's
and now make it now 98 days
are we,
until.
Are we sure?
Yeah. Yeah. I always forget to carry the one.
Let me get my calculator.
But it's Tuesday.
99 days to go until the November election. It's not it's not exactly the battleground that analysts expected. Again, this is Nate Cohen in the New York Times. It's not dominated by well-educated suburban districts that voted for Hillary Clinton. Instead, the battleground is broad, and it includes a long list of working class and rural districts that voted for Donald Trump in 2016. The broader battleground is a positive development for Democrats. It's a reflection of how much the Republican structural advantage in the House has eroded over the last year. What remains of it isn't helping the Republicans as much as analysts assumed it would, at least not yet. Again, 98 days. So they look at a lot of things. Battleground representative of non-urban America. This is suburbs and well-educated voters are only somewhat overrepresented. And they look at that. They say the broader battleground has also opened up a gap between two common ways of thinking about the midterms. National polls and historical voting patterns suggest that Democrats are only slight favorites to take the House, while early polls of individual districts, special election results, and the ratings of experts prognosticators suggest that Democrats are in a much stronger position.
So let's take a look at that.
Yes.
You know more. You guys know a lot more about that than I do. But when they say national polls, I mean, would you rather have a Democratic House or a Republican House? They're only 6 points ahead, you know, in that. That's a national poll. But when they do individual districts and the people there, that's where the Democrats are showing some advantage right now, although I find it all very difficult to believe.
I would also be really, really skeptical of polls, especially polls just within a district, just because we don't know. We don't know. I mean, we assume that the Democrats are more energized, but until we actually see that, it's hard to know how energized they are, and it's hard to know how. I mean, Trump's supporters are hardcore and devoted, and it's hard to know how many of them will show up. You know, will they show up mm-hmm. only when Trump's on the ballot, or will they show up to support Trump when he's not on the ballot?
And will they tell the truth? In other words,
right.
To a pollster, will they tell the truth to say, yes, I like this guy Trump who everybody hates? You don't know. It's fascinating.
And Trump is going to go and campaign in some of these toss-ups.
He said all of them.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. See if it brings out. I mean, it could backfire on Trump because it might really invite the Democrats to come out against him, and that might rev up the vote against the local candidate. Who knows? But it's very hard to predict.
It is.
All right, we have letters. We'll go to those.
Okay, Joe. Thank you. Regarding the lemonade stand.
The story of the day.
Just
the year.
One.
And this of is the what, year and maybe the decade.
You
and
think?
This is
okay.
why
it
goes
right.
on the front page of the paper.
I stand corrected.
Just wanted to clarify that the Saratoga County Fair had no part in shutting down the lemonade stand. Though vendors may have been involved, I don't believe the fair as a whole made any part.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And who's that written by?
We didn't say that. You know,
the public affairs person at the
Saratoga Fair? But I think that's true. I think it was the vendors within the fairgrounds. It was not the actual fair officials.
Yeah. And Hank said, incorrect information and comments. The city of Saratoga Springs City Council has taken action to allow the sale of water and Lucky Pencils. What's Lucky Pencil?
Oh, right, that's true. Then I apologize, but yeah, I knew that it was.
Oh, you can keep track of your winnings, and you need the little lucky. It's
lucky,
like the little miniature golf pencils.
Yeah.
So if you have a pencil, it may as well be a Lucky Pencil.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. You want an unlucky
lucky
pencil.
Lead is in that pencil.
Lucky Pencils outside the Saratoga race course.
It's not bad because you can get lucky for a quarter. Yeah. Go ahead.
Is that all it takes these days?
Yeah,
okay.
Your lumping of the city of Saratoga Springs with a DOH craziness, Department of Health craziness, in Boston Spa lemonade stand is inappropriate. Call a city official and find out the real story.
Well, there was the water thing, but I said that there are many lemonade stands around the track that seem that are operating just last week when I was there. it looks, I don't know. So yeah. Sorry we gave that impression.
Kids' lemonade
being taken
stand.
To task in the
they're
letters.
All about the lemonade stand.
About
every
lemonade.
One of
yeah.
these.
Yeah.
So
that's
far. Great. Hi, panel. There was a similar story on NPR last week about an 11-year-old African-American kid, I believe from the Chicago area, who had a stand selling lemonade and hot dogs in his neighborhood, and a neighbor complained. I don't recall the timeline details, but the final was that a politician paid the kid's permit fee and helped with the other things so that the kid could keep his stand. What is up with these adults getting on kids who are trying to do right with their lives? Well, and to say also to parents, I mean, how many parents say to their kid, okay, you're being a bit of a pain in the butt, go outside and sell lemonade, you know what I mean?
And give me the profit.
Right.
Right.
No, but the
right.
letter writer is right. There's been a string of these stories all around the country, and a lot of them involving black kids who are selling, who get, you know, tattled on by some
white
adult
ridiculous
with
person.
Nothing better to do. And
right.
And that's why I don't think you can dismiss this as a silly story. I do think it's part of a trend of people, tattletales. Is that,
well,
is that what you call them?
That's such a good point.
People who just can't just see something and just let it go.
This is government overreach, mm-hmm. you know, and
deep state,
and quite possible. I mean, this woman. Did she work for the permitting department of the Department of Health?
Sorry to interrupt.
They're not saying the inspector's name. They identified her as an inspector.
Inspector. Oh, she did. They did. I thought they said her name the other day in the paper.
But isn't it different that if there are complaints coming from within the well, let's say it's the vendors. We don't know, but let's say it was the vendors.
Well, we're reporting that it was. Charles.
Okay, that it was the
well,
vendors.
We don't know for sure, though.
I just after all the mail, I just thought I'd be
okay,
very.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yes, the vendors.
So let's say the vendors, mm-hmm. and they complain, and mm-hmm. they complain to the state health department. Then the health department comes out and is responding to that complaint. That is different than the health department driving from Albany to Saratoga and doing a raid, isn't
it? It's also a little different than this woman who might have been at the Saratoga fair then. Walking out and deciding, oh, I'm going to take my responsibility as a health inspector very seriously and shut down this little kid. We don't know what
it is. I mean, that's a fair point. It's a question of who to blame. When you talk about there was a case in San Francisco where a woman, I think, called the police on a black kid who was selling bottled water. Do we blame the police for showing up, or do we blame the woman for calling? I mean, I think ultimately you blame the woman for calling in the first place.
That's who I blame.
Yeah.
So anyway, so then Brenda wrote on a different subject.
Oh, really? We're moving on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, did you not want to move on?
Oh, no. I'm just making a joke.
We'll return to it. Don't worry.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Chris.
Most letters are about
Brenda wrote about gerrymandering. Hello, panel. I like this one.
All right.
I think Alan's comment on gerrymandering constraints should be taken as the most serious threat to midterm elections, and that's from Brenda.
Oh, that's...
Well, with this Supreme Court, the Supreme Court, that ain't going to happen. That is for sure, and all like that, and then we have another one here that says, "Good morning. The media has been extraordinarily lazy in reporting on collusion. First, the very order appointing Mueller does not contain the word collusion. Second." Mueller is investigating crimes like conspiracy, money laundering, and obstruction of justice. The media should stop using the word collusion, as that is not all of what Mueller is investigating.
I don't think the media is using the word collusion
as much as Trump is.
As only in response to the president of saying there is no collusion, which now Rudy Giuliani says is probably not even a crime.
And so did the president.
Yes,
the president
has
affirmed
his tweet
that collusion is no longer a crime.
Yes, one of his tweets.
This is pretty good.
There was no collusion, but if there was, it's okay.
Yeah, right. And that's basically, it's an admission of guilt.
Now, Tina wrote a letter. I anticipated it by saying, you know, don't hold your letters about why we eat cow when I commented on dog.
Yeah.
And Tina wrote a letter saying, why the dog and not the pig? Got it. We each have our favorites.
North Korea and South Korea, where dog is part of the diet, is being encouraged to be more like the Western world and just eat pigs, I guess, not dogs.
And cows.
And cows, yeah. Good point.
Okay.
Want another one?
Yes.
Benji writes a critical letter. Hi, panel. Big fan. However, it is not white privilege to have the privilege of joking about a government entity setting Alan's house on fire. I never said they were going to set my house on fire. Never said anything like it. Given the 40th anniversary of the Move-9 members being imprisoned on false charges, sadly, it's not a joke for some communities. So let us not forget when the police actually did bomb and set on fire the house of the Black Liberation Group Move. Thank you. And that's from Benji.
Oh, well, that's a much different story of what happened in Philadelphia in 1986.
Should we get into Waco, too?
That was Mayor Wilson Good. I was in Philadelphia at that time. I mean, that's a much, much different story.
Than a fire exercise along Allen Street.
Yes, I mean, I
Great Barrington.
Yeah, have trouble seeing that. Okay. Oh, I thought you were.
No.
Yeah, I thought you were signaling for something.
No, I'm just sort of okay. Let's
please.
Okay. All right. So, let's just go back to the battleground story just for a second, which is that one of the points that he makes is something that Mike was saying, and I believe Chris too, is that individual house polls are never much better than a rough indicator, and this is in the early stages of the race. But the overall pattern is fairly clear, and a similar pattern shows up in the special election results of the last year. Democrats have run far ahead of Mrs. Clinton in white working class areas that are back the president by a wide margin, including Connor Lamb's victory in Pennsylvania's 18th district, which we mentioned in March. They haven't run so far ahead of Mrs. Clinton in the areas where she excelled, like Georgia's 6th or Northern Virginia. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, in some ways, we might be reverting back to the old pattern where suburban, well-educated districts were traditionally more Republican, and white working-class areas were, you know, the old blue-collar Democrats. I mean, it's hard to tell if white working-class areas are leaving or growing skeptical about the Republican Party, that's a big deal because that's been their base for the last few election cycles.
And to say nothing of the idea that some of the working class families are the heaviest supporters of Trump, let's face it, because he has thrown
right.
Them
so are they annoyed that the Republicans aren't supporting Trump enough? Is that what's leading them? I mean, who knows?
It's well. Don't you think we're going to hear a lot about immigration and a lot about trade issues and how that's taking jobs away from Americans? Both are. You know, the immigrants are coming and taking your jobs, and the trade imbalance is costing you your jobs. And that was a very effective rhetoric in 2016.
Now, yes, but except now people are realizing they're losing their jobs because of the trade wars. You know,
the farmers know they
are behind the eight ball because of the trade wars, and this bailout, you know, is not really going to help. So, and we're going to be paying for it. I mean, that's the thing. Ultimately, this all comes out of our pockets. Their malfeasance and incompetence in running this government comes out of our pockets.
Yeah, I think a lot of the I think it's rhetoric right now. A lot of the impact is not going to hit a lot of people yet. I know there's been layoffs at companies that use steel in the U.S., and there's been a lot of suggestions that others are going to lose their jobs. But if it doesn't happen in the next 98 days, it's probably they'll get a buy on it.
Yeah, we'll see.
All right. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We have much more to talk about. We will do that right after the short break. Well, good morning. And I hope you all are having as much fun as we are here in the studio. WAMC.org, and you can just write to us at panel@WAMC.org and join in. We have letters. Alan Trachtak is here. Mike Spain is here. Chris Churchill and Libby Post making up the group. Alan has letters. Go ahead, sir.
I will. David says, the wall. What happened to Trump's claim that Mexico will pay for the wall? It was such a big campaign issue. Why isn't anyone calling him on it? Well, we've heard, I think anyone would be an unfair statement. A lot of people, you know, have mentioned it, but we have sort of moved on from it, so you make a point.
Well, David, it's coming back, I think.
Yeah.
But Mexico's not paying for it, though.
And John has frequently been critical. Trump polling numbers and the effect on the midterms, the panel predicted many times that President Trump's polling number would quickly approach the low 30s. Alan made this prediction. 2 years later, his numbers are peaking, economy booming, lowest unemployment rate in underserved population in history, and that translates to improved minority polling numbers. What is Allen's official midterm prediction? Well, no, I think this is going to be a very close election. I don't agree with much of what you said, John. I never do. But, But he's grinning now because, you know, he's landed one.
Well, he's got his 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah. So my prediction is, and I said so earlier in this program, that because of gerrymandering, and because it's so endowed that people, their passion will lead them to get out and do something. But I do see passion in a way I've never seen before. I had about three letters about how dare you have John Passo on your radio station, that kind of thing. And, you know, as long as I live or breathe, we'll be having everybody on. Delgado took his time getting back to us, but he will be in the studio on Monday.
I know I've said this before, but you cannot discount the passion of the resistance movements, the indivisible groups, the grassroots stuff that's happening all over the country, the marches that are happening. You know, I think that there's a sea change.
By the way, I think you're right. And I don't like agreeing with you.
I know. That's because you and I are both, you know.
Yeah.
I think if the Democrats do pull it off and have a historic midterm election where they win.
You and I are both what?
Yeah.
I'm not.
Okay,
we
go
had
ahead.
This conversation during the break.
Sorry, Mike.
I'm more interested in this. Right? No, if the Democrats pull it off, it'll be by a very thin margin, and it would behoove them to be very cooperative with the mainstream Republicans and try to foster some bipartisan agreement and give the Republicans an opportunity to discard those Tea Party people that are a small number that are controlling the whole House of Representatives.
Yeah, it's the Freedom Caucus.
Right.
So Brad says, taxes. When will the people impress upon Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike that the tax code is nothing more than a shell game? How about eliminating the tax code en masse and just implementing a tax on all earnings set as a percentage? Flat tax, in other words.
Graduated income tax is the only way that you can fairly tax people in this country. I mean, the billionaires can afford the 15 or 10% it would be, but right. For a guy making minimum wage, trying to feed a family, it's crippling.
Well, and Brad continues, no exemptions either. I can't think of anything that would be easier, more transparent, and fair. You know what? This tax system is now so loaded, as far as I'm concerned. I'm almost ready to take the flat tax, despite what you just said. You are right philosophically that it should be a progressive income tax. But because they have loaded it and they have exploited it the way they have, if they really were able to do this correctly, I would be for it.
Well, there's also another thing. We'd have to have a bailout for the accounting industry if there was just one postcard. There'd be all those unemployed and the people that work for those software companies like Intuit, you know, will all be out of work.
They'll figure something out, I'm sure. Did you want to say something, Chris?
No, I don't necessarily disagree with him that there might be better ways to tax us. I mean, the problem with exemptions tends to be that they are always written to benefit the people with political power, you know.
And K Street boys.
Right.
Say that again?
The K Street boys and girls.
The lobbyists. Right.
The lobbyists.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So thank you for that, Brad. Good letter. And Keith says, my first ever political donation. Good morning, panel. Delgado was not my first choice, but he is someone that I feel is well qualified to be a congressman. On your program yesterday, Faso claimed that he was one of the most bipartisan congressmen in the House. There is no such thing as bipartisanship in this House, and Faso has nothing tangible to show for it other than a statistic. Faso supports such leaders like Nunes, who are overseeing the Russian investigation, and that is enough for me to vote for Delgado. I'm a former Gibson and Pataki voter. I made my first ever political donation to Antonio Delgado, and Faso's race baiting is appalling, and that's from Keith.
Okay, so do you think that opinion is an outlier, or there are more people like that writer than we would think at first glance?
Well, clearly there are more. The question is how many more? The antipathy towards Trump in this state is just palpable. Wherever you go, you hear it. You hear about people who can't keep their lunch down, you know, and are not sleeping and doing
There's
all of that.
There's now a Trump disorder now that the psychiatrist diagnosed.
But anybody who identifies as a Chris Gibson and a George Pataki Republican is generally a moderate Republican, right. And there's not too many of those around these days.
Well, Faso is, when he talks about being bipartisan, he's referring to the Lugar Bipartisan Index, which does show him as one of the more bipartisan members of Congress.
That's right, because he comes from a district which demands it.
Right.
He's smart.
They let him vote for certain things when they have enough votes.
But we'll often told my students, you know, there are two terms which you watch here. One of them is called off the hook, meaning that, okay, I know in order to win, we got to let you go on this when we have enough votes, you're off the hook. And the other one is in the tank. Hey, John, we need your vote on this. You're going to do it. That's all there is to it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You're looking very perplexed there, Chris.
No. I got you.
That letter is indicative, though.
Not much
of,
you get.
That letter is indicative also of the suburban women. And we'll see how they come out and vote.
Yeah, there's some are predicting that suburban women, Trump's numbers among men is like 50-50. But among women, it's like 60-40. You know, they're against him.
Well, you saw that in the election, too. Yeah. I mean, suburban areas like Clifton Park, which were always very Republican, went for Hillary Clinton. But Trump was able to overcome that because he did so much better in rural areas than Republicans normally do.
Well, I'm just fascinated by it. When you take that original quote from Trump, which is up on the front of our house, Roselle has made a poster of it, you know, about, you know, grabbing women by the you-know-whats and doing all of that stuff.
It's in the front of the house?
Yeah.
Painted on
it's
the...
On
that might have brought the firemen there.
That's exactly it.
We might want to send a few inspectors that way. That might be a code violation.
Yeah, big, Inspector Gadget's
big banner.
Right.
Somebody call the police.
Well, it took us a long time to get our WAMC sign in our annex over here, too. Yeah. That's a shot. Okay.
really?
And
it's in the tank.
That was a
You
shot.
Were making a point, though, about the...
I
think so.
What was my point?
I think you're headed that way. I don't know. You started to talk about the sign out in front of your house and women and
yeah, I don't see how women can vote for this guy. I just don't get it. On the other hand, you get the very conservative religious vote that says nothing counts. Nothing he's ever said counts except on abortion.
That's right.
He's delivering the Supreme Court justice.
That's right.
But the question is, when you say they can't vote for this guy, when people head to the polls in the midterm elections, do they think they're voting for or against this guy, meaning Trump, or do they think they're voting for and against Faso, or is it some sort of complicated,
very,
you know?
It's a very good question.
That's what I was just asking in that letter writer, who was definitely making the connection between Faso and his support of Nunes and other people in the Russian investigation. So, I mean,
that
there seems to be a clear...
it's hard to...
But not everybody makes those.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, Americans do not vote that way. They do it in France. They do it in England. They don't do it that way here. They vote for, quote, our guy. Mm-hmm. Now, in this case, our guy, and by the way, I've known John Faso for a long time. If you vote for our guy, he is without question going to vote for continuing the Republican leadership. So the House will not flip if Faso is elected. It's that simple, right? I mean, you can like John, but at the same time, you have to recognize that in this case, the only way that Trump is going to be held accountable is if the House flips.
Yeah, that's true. People vote that way. I agree with you. They're going to vote for him because they like him. I mean,
Because they saw him at the fair or whatever.
Well, this has always been a country that votes by personality.
Yeah, but maybe
contest.
Not this time. Maybe
we'll
not
see.
This time. Okay, and David says, comment, Trump tweeted this morning that collusion is not a crime, but that doesn't matter because there was no collusion except by crooked Hillary and the Democrats. Interesting. So Trump is saying that crooked Hillary isn't crooked after all. My head spins. That's interesting. In other words, if crooked Hillary was involved in collusion and collusion isn't a crime, then
how can they
Hillary,
lock her up? That's what I'd like to
crooked
know.
Crooked Hillary is not crooked.
I wouldn't spend too much time analyzing those tweets and trying to figure them out. Just let them go.
I have pointed out, Chris, a number of times that while it's crazy, he is the president of the United States and somehow he fooled. Oh, no, he got it. He got those votes. Okay.
Well, that's 70,000.
But the Twitter, I mean, this is...
I know, can't just ignore it. But
I mean, they're official. They have been deemed as official White House statements. The Mueller investigation has now said they're going to look at those tweets. So I agree with you entirely, and I know what you're saying, but you do, words matter, and you have to take this stuff seriously.
I'm not saying that they're not newsworthy or they're not worth paying attention to, but on the other hand, a lot of them just don't make any sense.
You know, no, they don't.
I saw something on CNN this morning which really got me thinking, and which was the absolute assumption that Mueller could not indict because there was an agreement you can't indict a sitting president, right? You can't indict a sitting president.
That's a legal opinion that needs to be tested by
from the Department of Justice. That's what right.
Well, that's the Dershowitz camp of interpretation.
No, it has merit. I mean, there's a whole philosophy that the Constitution takes care of a dishonest or a president committing crimes, and that is the impeachment process.
But I've never gotten
it. It should
that.
Be exempt from the other things. But that's a point of view. It has to be tested.
But it's a stupid point of view. And I'm going to tell you why it's so stupid.
Because it's not mine, by the way. I'm just saying.
No, I got it. But it's because he said he could kill somebody, shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue.
Right.
And you say, okay, let's see the guy takes out a revolver and kills somebody. You mean to say, in broad daylight, you mean to say you have to impeach him first? That's absurd.
Yeah, in that argument, people will come back, attorneys will come back and say, in those cases where it's a violent one-on-one crime, that's a different category of indictment, and you could indict a president for that.
Well, you know, it's those one cases, those some cases that get you. The only time I've really seen Mario Cuomo really angry at me in all those years of doing that show was at one point when he said he was not for anybody ever being killed, executed, ever. And I said to him, Eichmann? I got a call afterwards. You shouldn't have done that. So anyway, panel, the bottom line is driving American jobs away. Why pay a man $25 an hour when you can pay somebody $5 a week to make your product, and that is Anthony. So anybody get that?
Is that about the lemonade stand?
No, maybe it's about foreign trade. Well, okay. it's a hot issue with people who are losing good jobs, right. Manufacturing, and they go overseas, and that's not an incorrect number that the writer cites. Usually it's more than that, but I mean somebody might make pennies a day to make a T-shirt in some place like El Salvador or in Vietnam, and where that same garment worker in the U.S. would make, you know, $20-$25 an hour, mm-hmm. perhaps, yeah.
All right, so let us talk about two stories I think we'll have time for in our last 5 minutes. The Manafort trial is beginning, the trial of Paul Manafort. Mr. Trump's former campaign chairman concerns his work as a consultant in Ukraine, but the subtext weighs not just on the prosecution and defense, but certainly also on the White House. So what is at stake here? Questions about Russian involvement in the president's 2016 campaign are not on the docket, but they certainly hang heavily over the proceedings. The main points to be aware of: it is the first trial stemming from charges brought by Robert Mueller III. Prosecutors say they do not intend to delve into questions about collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign in the case, which focuses on how Mr. Manafort handled the money he earned working as a consultant in Ukraine. The trial is expected to last at least 3 weeks. A second trial is scheduled to follow starting in September. In that case, Manafort will face related charges in U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. 32-count indictment with charging Mr. Manafort with disguising more than $30 million in overseas income by moving it through offshore accounts, lying to banks, and evading taxes.
So this is all about, of course, Mueller trying to get Manafort to flip. And everybody knows that. Now, what is Manafort thinking? Get inside his head. He's thinking, well, if I hold out long enough, maybe Donald Trump will pardon me. And there was a lot of talk about that. And a lot of people think that the reason that Trump was pardoning so many people back a couple of weeks ago was as a signal to some of these guys that if they just stayed with him, he would eventually pardon them. But put yourself in Manafort's place. Would you be thinking that I'd like to avoid spending, you know, the next 15, 20 years in prison?
Yeah, it's important to realize, too, that these charges that Manafort is going on trial for, both trials, are not covering the period when he was the campaign manager for the president. It was prior to that. This all came out during the investigation of the campaign, and they found all his alleged illicit money laundering and stashing money that he got from the Russians in foreign bank accounts, et cetera. And that's what he's.
So why is that so important, Mike?
Well, it didn't happen during the campaign.
Yeah,
it is not about Trump's campaign. It's just showing this guy is dirty, and he ran the campaign, and then maybe he was running the campaign in a dirty way, but that's not coming up in this campaign.
I don't think that's what this is about. I think this is about getting him to flip, period.
Well, yeah, a lot of pressure on him to flip, sure.
All right, other story that I wanted to get to, and that is the Iran meeting. President Trump says he would meet with the Iranian leader, but Iran rules it out. The president yesterday, who walked away from nuclear deal with Iran despite the country's documented compliance, said Monday that he would meet with the president with no preconditions as soon as the Iranian leader agreed to do so. Well, the Iranian leader
didn't want to know part of that.
Because they said he doesn't keep his word, as in destroying the agreement.
And Mr. Trump said, I'll meet with anybody. If they want to meet, I'll meet anytime they want.
Now, the interesting thing is that the locus of power there does not go to the president. It goes to the Ayatollah, who's sitting at the top of the whole thing. So in these other cases, he was talking to the head man. In this case, he would be talking to somebody who is subservient to the head man.
Yeah, I think Trump is right to meet with anybody. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily. I think that's probably a good strategy. A good. But it's not going to happen.
And you know, he's taking a lot of liberties here. He said with the Italian Prime Minister yesterday, he said, "Look at all the good things that are happening. We defanged the nuclear threat from Korea, and look at the good things that happened from my meeting with Putin." Except that nobody has the slightest idea what his meeting and Putin produced.
Yeah, and we don't know what North Korea produced really either. Yeah, I mean, it's all the meetings have produced very vague results.
Good video for the re-election commercials. He met with world leaders. You know,
right.
I'm not sure that Putin video will be one they'll be putting in commercials.
It'll
be in commercials, but not there.
Yeah. Putin's re-election campaign.
That's right. Yeah. I'm sorry, Libby.
No, just the commercials. He met with North Korea and denuclearized the peninsula.
He made the world safe.
And he won a Nobel, even if he didn't win it.
Larry Nobel of Cleveland.
Right. Yes.
Gave him an award.
All right, we're out of time. My thanks to everybody for being here. That was very fun. Libby, thank you very much. Chris, Mike, Alan.
I'm on the way home to see Murray.
Okay, good. You got an interview first.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then you can go see the dog. We'll be back right after this. Mm-hmm.